And good afternoon. Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. We're going to be talking about jumped into three things at once. Jane Jacobs' 100th anniversary of her birth is coming up, and there's a new book out about her, and it features an interview she did with Robin Philpott of Baraka Books, often a guest on the show, and he was privileged to have the last interview given by Jane Jacobs, whose name will live on because of the importance of her theories and observations and a great role she played here in Toronto. And we're going to begin the program today. We're going to talk, of course, about the death of Prince and this great performer. And we're going to be speaking with Norman Otis Richmond, bluesologist, authority on music, and knows a great deal about also the political history and background of so much of the great American culture. And Norman joins us now. Are you there, Norman? Hello.
How are you?
How are you?
Oh, I'm wonderful. Can you hear me?
I can hear you pretty good, and we'll leave the rest to nature. The only thing you might do is make sure you speak right into the phone, but I think everything is fine, near as I can make out. I'm going to mention three names I want to make sure we talk to you about today. One is of course, Prince. But then also on the weekend, we lost yesterday, Sunday, Papa Wemba died on stage in Abidjan, Ivory Coast, another great figure, and I know you know about him. And there's a footnote I want to get your opinion on, and that'll be Harriet Tubman being put on the American $20 bill and putting Jackson to the back. Well, that's esoteric matter. We'll get to that. Well, first of all,
could I answer the first one first? I mean,
last one
Papa
first.
Wemba. Before we go into it, Papa Wemba. There was a guy that I knew by the name of Johnny Guitar Watson. He died on stage in Japan, and I think one of the members of Chic died on stage. He died. Bernard. I can't remember his name. And also Felipe Wynn, the lead singer of the Spinners. He died on stage, so that's just a little for your information.
There is always a talk that the performer's dream, whether they're actors, even athletes, there's an old saying about athletes, leave it all on the field. There's a sense in which they would like to, that's what, after all, they do, that's what they excel at, and there's almost an idea that that would be the way to pass out.
I want just say one other thing. Johnny Guitar Watson was a great guitar player. He was a multi-instrumentalist, and he basically influenced Etta James, and Etta James said that he should be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But the reason I'm mentioning Johnny Guitar Watson is because I was responsible, or I helped Johnny Guitar Watson. I introduced Johnny Guitar Watson to Eduardo Montalan Jr., mm-hmm. whose father was the founder of Frelimo, mm-hmm. and as a result of that meeting, Johnny Guitar Watson wrote a song called Asante Sana, you know, thank you very much, uh-huh. in Swahili. So that's one of just a little bit of history.
This is Norman Otis Richmond, and Norman has always written about all these matters, and has always pointed out how aware many of the greatest artists in music have a drive in them that's associated with the causes of their time. And let's mention, of course, this is Prince. And I think the world is, in the days now, talking about him, starting to realize he had some pretty strong opinions about what was going on. And he managed to work it into his art at a time when he was in pop music, where it's very dangerous often to careers to have any opinion at all on anything. But I guess I better just ask you, tell us about Prince. You saw him perform. And what was that like?
I saw him perform twice very early in his career in 84. 84, he performed in Detroit, Michigan at Cobalt Hall. I actually went to Cobalt Hall to see him perform. It was when he had out the album Purple Rain, and he also had out the film. Mm-hmm. And I remember we were driving into Detroit, and when we came in Detroit, we saw, you know, a photograph of Ali, Frazier, and Floyd Patterson with Ronald Reagan, and it said champs for Reagan, and someone had wiped it out and it says chumps for President Reagan, you know. And I never will forget that. And we saw Prince, and Prince put on a whoo. He mesmerized the audience. And then I saw the same show about 2 weeks later. He played in Maple Leaf Gardens here. He did two shows, and I saw the first one he did, and that's the only time I saw him live, but he was very, very, very impressive. But on October 18th, 1978, there was a newspaper in Toronto called Contrast, which was ran by a young man by the name of Al Hamilton, and I wrote the first article that I know of about Prince in this country, and it this is a direct quote. I said, Warner Brothers has another Stevie Wonder in their new 18-year-old artist, Prince.
Mm.
On his first Warner Brothers album, Prince did it all. He composed the music, produced the session, played the instruments, which included drums, guitar, bass synthesizers, and more. Prince is the youngest person to ever produce a Warner Brothers album. The album is For You, and the single Soft and Wet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this was in connection to his Purple Rain film. And there is a, believe this or not, this is another thing that will really, a lot of people don't know. There's actually a filmmaker in Niger in Africa that's doing an African version of Purple Rain.
Mm-hmm.
And that is coming out pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. No, ask me a question. I'm sorry.
I was just curious. And again, this is Norman Otis Richmond, bluesologist. You could just put his name in and you come up with a whole bunch of things. And so what was it? Now, you mentioned he could do anything. He play all these instruments. He's one of those guys that sort of picks a thing up, and an hour later you say, oh, he can do it. Is that what you know? What was it that struck you that made you say, well, this is another Stevie Wonder coming?
The fact that he could play all those instruments, that he could write, that he could compose, and I did not know anything about his politics, because, you know, when he first came out of the box, he was singing about sex.
Yeah,
and,
that,
you know, a lot
that,
of sex on his first album. But the way he used a lot of double entendres and very clever. I mean, never on stage. Now he could get pretty graphic, but on records, it was a double entendre, which was a masterpiece that African people have. And I have to give the Trinidadians, the Calypsonians, are the masters of the double entendre and the blues singers.
Mm-hmm.
So Prince, you know, he was singing some pretty graphic stuff, but you couldn't really tell. I mean, you could tell, but he would say it in such a way that it wouldn't be censored.
Uh-huh.
You know, but
which takes some doing.
Go ahead.
I said that takes some doing, because the cultural police are usually out and around with their flashlights and their informers. They like to bring down actors and performers. Particularly, they like to stop them before they get started. In a way,
right?
You know, he's very. I found I couldn't take my eyes off the guy. I got to say that I wasn't one who followed these things closely. But once you looked at him in a performance, I was struck by what Miles Davis talked about, and it seems so eccentric and an observation, but that's what Miles is good at. Miles said, this man is like Marvin Gaye, James Brown,
Charlie Chaplin.
Charlie Chaplin. And you say, well, wait a minute, let's run back a minute. And he had that thing of knowing how to freeze, and it became a photograph, you know?
I think Charlie Chaplin, you should do a whole show on Charlie Chaplin. I would like to hear if you could get an expert on Charlie Chaplin, because Charlie Chaplin is a man that he was much deeper than a lot of people think he was a serious political human being.
Yeah. Let's go into business. He and Michael Jackson's names now are going to be linked. They certainly talked about, always in the same sort of in the same paragraphs when you start talking about American pop music, and they both became huge. And one of the comments I've seen is that they broke free of the business, and both of them hated the business. And Prince used the word plantation, which comes up a lot with black performers, black athletes, and people get mad when NBA players mention that they're on a plantation. And it has to do with the limitations of what they can say and do. And in the case of Prince, what he wanted to release. But the way they broke through, according to the observation I heard, was that both of them captured the video market. When video suddenly took over in the music business, both of them were at the front.
Oh, that is correct. But Prince, he broke with Warner Brothers and stopped using his name. He referred to himself as the artist formerly known as, and then there's photographs of him. If you go to Google Images, he had a slave on his face, and he, you know, had the term slave on his face, mm-hmm. and he basically forced the record companies to, he got his way because he was that powerful. He went back to Warner Brothers. You know, a lot of people are saying he went back to Warner Brothers and he passed away. Now that he's passed away, but he got his masters back, which is, you know, a few artists like Sam Cooke, Ray Charles, and many of the reggae. I don't know if Bob Marley owns his masters or if Chris Blackwell owns his masters, but
not many of the biggest people do.
Own your masters and you have the publishing. Sam Cooke, Ray Charles, people like that, they figured it out early. Also, Lloyd Price from Louisiana. Lloyd Price, Lordy, Lordy, Miss Claudie, but Lloyd Price spent 10 years living in Nigeria, and he was close to Don King for whatever that's worth. But he understood the publishing, and Prince was a well-read human being. If you saw Prince, he used to be on Tavis Smiley's show all of the time. And I was shocked to listen to him just sit there and talk about political current events in history. And, you know, he would always preface the fact he's a Jehovah's Witness, so therefore he was not political. And then he was best friends with Cornel West and, like I say, Tavis Smiley. When Michael Jackson ran out of money for the Malcolm X film, it was Prince was one of the people who helped him, finance the Malcolm X film. When the situation in Baltimore took place, it was Prince who did a concert, and he did a very political song about that, called Baltimore. Yeah. The whole question of reparations, the Staples Singers did a song called When Will We Be Paid for the Work We've Done. They recorded that in Africa in 1971. Mm-hmm. Prince, he covered that, and he kept on talking about reparations, and, you know.
Hey, I got a line from him. I got to pass to you that you must have seen it. He said, he says, you tell me that we're all in the same boat, but how come I'm the only one rowing?
Well, you know, like Archie Shepp would say, it's always been a question of European control over African creativity. But, you know, that whole question of, African music, black music, African people have talked about reparations in music for years and years. Reggae music, I remember, if you listen to reggae music today, you know, do you remember the days of slavery? I guess Burning Spear recorded that in the 70s. But I just put something on Facebook called 40 Acres and a Mule by Oscar Brown Jr. That was done in 1964. And Oscar Brown Oscar Brown Sr., his father, led a state called the Establishment of the 49th State Movement. He wanted to put together a separate state for black people in the 30s and 40s.
That was a serious political issue, the so-called Black Belt, which was identified as a region that could be made into a black nation or state.
And also, you know, there was a guy by the name of Martin Delaney. He talked about Africa for the Africans in, I guess it was 1854, maybe. He went to Nigeria with a Jamaican brother by the name of Robert Campbell. There's a book that they wrote.
Yes.
But, you know, then Denmark Vesey called for the overthrow of slavery, and I guess in 1829. So it's, you know, the history of, it's beginning to be told now that, you know, the American Negro was supposedly the passive one who never fought back, and, you know, he would see a white woman and salivate and see a white man and jump, you know. But, you know, the history is being corrected, and, you know, it's, let me put it this way. Prince was a continuum of artists, but the difference between Prince, a lot of the political artists, Paul Robeson, and the jazz artists, they're not popular music. So, you know, Duke Ellington was writing songs about Nat Turner in 1934, but that's not popular music. So, you
by
know
the way, me. Yeah, I mentioned Miles Davis. Miles Davis has a great album, Jack Johnson.
Well, yes, sir.
And Jack, if there's one name white America doesn't seem to want to hear, is Jack Johnson.
It's just like Jack Johnson.
Sales drop.
Jack Johnson was friends with Rasputin. Jack Johnson lived in Mexico, and Jack Johnson was in Cuba. You know, Jack Johnson was there was a song by Burning Spear called Spongy Reggae, and there's a line in there where you talked about being a genuine character. I saw something on the other day that Jack Johnson actually invented the monkey wrench. That was invented by Jack Johnson.
Mm-hmm. This is Norman Otis Richmond, and the song that the most recent and must have had a lot of impact, does have a lot of impact, is the song Baltimore. Could you talk about that? What do you think of that as a piece of music?
Oh, that was a powerful, powerful piece of music, and that he wrote that in 2015, and that was as a result of Freddie Gray was murdered by was killed by the police, and Prince did a concert, and he did that song, and this is a quote on the article that I wrote. CNN reported that his promotional material stated this is to the concert that he invited people to in Baltimore. Wear something gray in remembrance of Freddie Gray, who died from several spinal injuries after his arrest last month. You know, the police, I guess they beat that poor young man to death in a police car.
They had this little thing where they would lock you in the back of a vehicle with no seatbelt and then make you fly.
Yes.
I mean, it's just like you see people in space. Well, that's what happens. High-speed vehicle running over bumps and anything he could do it and swerving. And that was a form of torture. Apparently, the Baltimore police are well known for it.
Yep, and, you know, Prince did a song called Dreamer. And this is another quote from the article that I wrote in The Burning Spear. The article is called Prince, the Great Musician and His Connection to Africans Worldwide, but it says one of Prince's songs, Dreamer, captures the feelings of many of us in the African Liberation Movement. The song expresses, quote, I was born, raised on a slave plantation in the United States in the red, white, and blue. Never knew I was different till Dr. King was on a balcony lying in a bloody pool. That's the end of quote. You know, that's one of Prince's signature songs, and uh, he he would get on Tavis Smiley's show with he and Cornel West, and they would talk about that. But I encourage everybody to go to PBS, and you can Google those shows and see them again and again and again. Tavis Smiley and Prince were quite close, and he was a Jehovah's Witness for whatever that is worth. But he was a Seventh-day Adventist, and he became a Jehovah's Witness. He was converted.
I believe that guitar player was from Toronto, wasn't he? The one who introduced him to.
No, that's Drake's uncle, Larry Graham.
Uh-huh.
Larry Graham is I'm Gonna Add Some Bottom. That's Sly and the Family Stone's bass player. That's great. That is Drake's uncle.
And, not an Adventist. I misled. I don't want anybody to think that.
Right, Larry Graham.
Did I say Adventist? I meant Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah, he was the one that converted Prince to the Jehovah's Witness. I think he was brought up a Seventh-day Adventist.
Yeah. Something. How about Michael Jackson was Jehovah's Witness?
Yeah, he was Jehovah's Witness, and his many people.
And he was raised in the church.
He had converted to Islam. I don't know how true that is, but I spoke to Jermaine Jackson. Jermaine Jackson is a Muslim, and he took Michael to, I don't know if it was Dubai, somewhere in the Middle East, and Michael lived there for a long time. And there are many people say that Michael had taken his shahada. Now, whether or not that's true, I don't know. But I know Jermaine Jackson is a Muslim, and I met Jermaine Jackson, and he was laughing about religion, because he basically says, Mama, talking about his mother, she was a Jehovah's Witness, but Daddy is an atheist. That's Joe. He said, Joe was born in Alabama, but he grew up in Oakland, so he was was kind of a secular human being,
Well, it certainly is an interesting and exotic combination of elements that make up the character of this personality, Prince. By the way, his father's name was Prince, was it not? He was a performer.
His father was a musician, and his mother was a dancer, and his father, I think, was a musician. And for whatever it's worth, he had Louisiana roots. I did some research.
Okay, we can stop and mention you are from Louisiana.
Oh yeah, he came out of both of his parents were born in Baton Rouge, and the Prince told the press that he had a biracial background, and of course, all of us, including myself, have a biracial background. If you're black, and if you're an American, if you're probably in North America.
Yes.
If you're from Barbados, maybe you don't have any,
It's like Ishmael Reed says, he's black Irish.
Yeah. Well, I'm black.
He went to an Irish meeting. They were kind of surprised to see him.
Yeah, I got a little Choctaw, but Prince his parents came out of Louisiana, and while we're talking about Louisiana, I want to let everybody know that Little Willie John, the guy who did Fever, he has Louisiana roots too. So we have produced some pretty good some heavyweights when it comes.
I'm really glad you mentioned Little Willie John. I always take my hat off when I hear his name.
Jimmy Fever.
They murdered him.
Yeah, they killed. Oh, no, that's another something we.
25 years old in a Washington jail.
He was killed in the prison. That's right.
Terrible. We're speaking Norman Otis Richmond, and given the time here, I better ask you this: we have to another great giant, Papa Wemba, died on the weekend.
I didn't know that until you told me.
Yeah, and what a shock! But on the platform, he was performing in Abidjan. And I know that he had this song, which I was knocked out by. It's called "Slave," in which he mentions all the great African and African American heroes, but he also says right at the end he makes an appeal for Winnie Mandela. Which is quite striking. Maybe that's why a lot of people haven't heard about it. But anyway, tell us about him. He is a Congolese.
He was from the Democratic Republic of Congo. And the Democratic Republic of Congo, Zaire, at one point when Mobutu Sese Seko Wazabanga took over, who was the, maybe one of the worst Africans. I used to say the worst African that ever lived. He's one of the worst Africans that ever lived. He was basically, he collaborated in the murder of Patrice Lumumba. But the thing about Papa Wemba is that Papa Wemba, for a long time, he had to leave Zaire to record because Mobutu, who had, you know, billions of dollars, the only studios they had in Zaire were maybe 8-track. They had the worst. They had no recording studios. And many of the major artists, you know, they were forced to basically do the, I don't know what you call it, when you have to pay, praise the leader, you know, basically suck up to whoever's in power. And a lot of artists, instead of doing that, they went to France because of, you know, the repression and also the fact that the music, Congolese music, Lingala music, some people call it, or Soukous, is the most popular music on the continent and some of the most popular music on the planet Earth. This man, who was a billionaire, filed 50,000 times, you know, Mobutu, had no studios there, and Papa Wemba was one of the people that had to go to Paris in order to basically to make his name. But there was a song that I played on my show,
it was I like that because you have to sing it to introduce it, which means I can't do that.
And he had a woman. It was like a duet, and I think he sang part of it in.
You know, I wanted to play it, but I was afraid I wouldn't get her name. Do you know who that woman was? I saw her on a video. She's terrific.
I don't see any credit for her, but you know, this is a male-dominated society. Like I used to play the song. I still don't know who the woman is, and I've said it publicly that it is like.
We will correct this. We're both humiliated. I'm being pointed at as I speak.
She sings, and she made such a contribution to this song, and she's a human being, but I haven't seen. I don't know her name.
Well, we'll
all I know is
that.
I love her voice, and I love the video.
Well, last observation here. This is Norman Otis Richmond. By the way, again, just Google his name. I was going to tell you how to get directly to it, but magic of Google, you'll get there before I could tell you. But we got to ask you, and it'd be a good place to close out, particularly now that we've raised the issue of women and African American women. Harriet Tubman is going to be put on the $20 bill. What do you think about that?
No, I don't. it's a joke.
Is it too little, too late?
It has a lot to do with the black with the Black Lives Movement and the movement as a whole. I mean, it's a concession. I mean, you know, to the Panthers, to the League of Revolutionary Black Workers.
Is it also an Obama legacy that his presidency, this decision is made?
Oh, I guess I would really prefer if his legacy would be freeing Leonard Peltier and Mumia Abu-Jamal and getting Asata secure some respect. But I guess.
Well, you could probably see this as the long war to replace every last one of those people on American currency. Wouldn't you say?
Oh yeah.
I mean,
so we're supposed to have a woman on a woman in Canada on the what is the $100 bill or what are they going to put a woman on?
They are talking. Isn't that interesting? The Americans decide to put Harriet Tubman on the 20, and all of a sudden the Canadian newspapers are full of talk about let's put a woman on our currency.
I think they should put Sharona Hall on the money.
I'm going to pencil that in. I think it's not officially a nomination yet. Well, Norman, I think we better go, but I'd like that. I'm going to come back in the future. You and I are going to talk about your nominee for Canadian currency, all right?
Okay.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, and we're going to play a little music for you, and we'll come back on the other side talking to Robin Philpott about Jane Jacobs.